I'm Jack Elhai, and this is Long Lost, an investigative history series from Twin Cities PBS. Early in my return to researching the Klein brothers' case, I visited the North Minneapolis neighborhood where the family lived in 1951. It's hard to say why I needed to go there so long after they disappeared, except that when three little boys vanish, I wanted to know where they vanished from, what was left behind, and what can those surroundings tell us now. It was a chilly weekday, late in the morning. I decided to first go to Farview Park, the brothers' destination when they disappeared. It was one of the first parks created in Minneapolis, and it had the park system's first ice skating rink and plumbed toilets. I imagined all the picnics, games, dog walks, romantic trysts, and other fragments of life the park had seen on its 20 acres over more than 130 years. But when I arrived, the park was absolutely deserted. No cars in the parking lot, no activity or kids playing anywhere in sight. The park seemed devoid of life and intent on not sharing its past. It was a lonely place. I then went to the old Klein house, three blocks away. Here, too, the scene was quiet. I'll bet this block looks pretty much the same as it did when the Kleins lived here, maybe with the exception of some different colors on the house, different kinds of siding or stucco applied, and maybe the trees look different. The Kleins moved out of this house into the Monticello area within a couple of years of the boys disappearing. Mrs. Klein said that she didn't want Gordon and the boys that were to come to grow up with that hanging over them. This is it right here with the art object hanging on the porch. You can imagine the boys spilling out of that door, all in a pile, running down the steps and heading down to 29th Avenue to go to the park. And you can imagine the family hanging out on the porch. If this tragedy hadn't occurred in this family, then they may well have stayed in this house for many more years. Yeah, looks like an ordinary house, but it has an extraordinary past. Inside that house, a family lived in limbo. At times, family members expectantly hoped, and at other times, they sank and despaired. Every day, the case of the missing brothers, Kenneth Jr., David, and Danny, grew colder. The coldness seeped into the house. The Kleins kept searching, but they had no outside perspective on when a cold case gets too cold to pursue. I didn't have that perspective either, so I enlisted the help of Everett Doolittle.
Now, just for the purpose of humor, I am Dr. Doolittle, by the way.
Okay.
I went and got my doctorate and taught at Metro State for about 14 years and then retired again.
In addition to his college teaching, Dr. Doolittle worked for 19 years as a field agent, senior special agent, and supervisor of the Minnesota Cold Case Homicide Unit at the State Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. He has written extensively about the investigation of cold cases and is known for his writings about the disease of certainty, which afflicts crime investigators when they focus too narrowly on one possible solution for a crime.
I'm going to explain how difficult this is. First, working cold case, it's like a business. And this might sound cruel, and I'm going to be just, you have to look at the probability of success, because if the business never sells their product, they don't exist. And one of the things you have to look at is solvability. You have no crime scene, you have no witnesses, you have no evidence, and you don't even have for sure that this is a homicide. Now, what you do have, which is quite, and I'll correlate it to another case, you have three young kids early in life who disappeared. The Marlis Wallenhaus case was a girl out of Afton who was murdered. There was really no evidence to speak of. There was really no suspects or too many. Only strength that case had is the whole community cared. It was 20 years later, all her classmates lived in the town. Everybody knew her. Everybody, you know, lived with the fear even 20 years later and who killed her. And that was the strength of that case. With everything I said, with all probabilities, I should have never touched that case in the first place. But we did, because of the victim.
And what happened?
We solved it. We solved it. Once we got into those files, once we start taking things apart to the level we do, we found many, many things that were invisible. And then, like I said, through the help of the media, was my friend. Now, law enforcement, you don't think of that. Media was my bread and butter.
All this made me think of Betty's televised plea in 1951 and how the need for media attention in cases like this hasn't really changed. One seasoned reporter who came up again and again in conversation about the case was Caroline Lowe, a veteran investigative journalist who covered Minnesota's biggest crime stories in the 1990s, including Jacob Wetterling and the 1995 disappearance of Iowa news reporter Jody Huizentrout. And it was Caroline's reporting on the Klein case that brought it to the attention of Sergeant Jim Schultz and, in many ways, has brought us all here now.
What I remember is about 20 years ago, it was 1999, I was a crime reporter at WCCO-TV in Minneapolis. And even though I was on the day-to-day crime beat, one of my passions developed was for unsolved cold cases. And the Klein brothers case was brought to our attention. It was an old case then, but it just, as a mom, it just seemed so heartbreaking. How do you lose three kids, never know what happened to them? And just seems like there was this huge mystery over these boys and no answers. And I, in more recent years, had covered Jacob Wetterling's abduction, which is the biggest story in Minnesota history, and others. And but how could there not be more still going on in their case? So we did some digging, our I team did some digging, and we ended up putting together a story. Generated some interest, sadly, 20 years later, it's still just as unsolved as it was back then. But it still stays with me. And your podcast and your book, I think, is going to renew the interest and dig things up and maybe get answers this time around.
Dig things up. Is Caroline's choice of words accidental? The boys are buried, figuratively or literally. And as we near the end of this investigation, they and their fate are just as buried as when we began. I'm frustrated. I wish we could have accomplished more. We still don't know what happened to the Lost Brothers, but we do know more about what happened to their family. That's important. And I'm confident that this podcast will help lead the family to more certainty.
You have, of course, a lot of experience reporting on cases like this, and then a very long connection with the Jody Huizentrout case. And I'm wondering, from that, what kind of strategy or techniques you developed for working with families who are in crisis, looking for answers, have been disappointed in the past?
Most families I know really don't like the word closure. It's maybe resolution, it's answers, but they don't, what is closure? And I've found that over the years, because part of what they have to live with are various scenarios, or if there's a body found and they go through this whole thing of, is this my loved one? And then turned out not to be, or some another name pops up, and or they hear about some serial killer, and could that person be somehow implicated in their loved one's crime? And then they read the horrific details about what that killer has done, and they think, could that person have done that to my loved one? And there's just all this stuff they have to live with. That uncertainty, to me, is just a living hell to not know. And never forget they're human beings. Never forget this is not a story. This is not just an investigation. Never lose your heart. As Edna Buchanan, the crime writer, once wrote, you never want to get calluses on your heart. So you may be digging and you have to continue to do that, but keep in touch with the family. I talk with Jody's sister regularly, with her friends. If a story's coming up, I try to give them heads up so they're not surprised. Tell them, if we know this is coming, it may be a big deal, may not be a big deal, or we haven't checked this out. Just keep them in the loop, because they live with the mystery of the unknown, and it's horrible. As horrible as it would be in Jody's case and the Klein brothers' case to find them and find their remains, it's worse to keep wondering about an unsolved scenario. It's unfinished business. And as I'm talking to you, I'm looking at the flyer from the Klein brothers, the flyer with David Klein and his brothers. I'm looking at Jody's picture. I keep her photo with me and Jacob Wetterling's in front of me every day to keep going and remembering it's a family. It's not a story, not just an investigation, but it's somebody's loved one who's not come home. It's easy to move on to the next one, and you're going to have another book. You're going to have other projects. I'll have other things, but don't forget these people. Keep photos nearby. Don't let them go away. Don't let them fade from your own memory so you stay on it.
I think for a long time, at the forefront of my memory will be the basement, Lloyd Paddock's basement, the one whose concrete floor he poured just after the boys disappeared. We and the Kleins need a reckoning with that basement. What's beneath its floor?
Going back to the basement for a second, if someone were to get a look at it and get in there, what would be your ideal scenario of what happens, of how that examination goes? And we've heard about cadaver dogs and sounding equipment.
Ground-penetrating radar.
Right, that kind of thing. What do you think would be the best way to look at it?
If an opportunity is there to go into that house and to look through that basement, in my mind, I think probably the best approach is all of it. You could get dogs in there to see what they find, if there's any indication of anything. The ground-penetrating radar, and somebody who's really good at running it to get down there and cover it. And then as far as soil samples go, that involves drilling through the concrete in numerous places around in a systematic way and making sure that it's properly collected and cataloged and, you know, do as much as you can to eliminate any contamination. And also for the family or the individual who owns that home, have a plan in place for them so that we can leave it in as good a shape or better when we're finished.
Sounds expensive.
Yes.
I would say if you, as far as going into there, you would need a qualified expert to do that. One point in time we did check about renting a ground penetrating radar and what it would take. And it would have been us kind of chasing ourselves around in the dark, because even if we had permission to go in there, neither of us really know how to handle that or what we're looking at. So
right.
It would have to be somebody with expertise. It can't just be us, you know. But yes, there is an expense. There's also organizations, though, that do volunteer work or do work with other organizations looking into this type of situation.
I tried to reach the owners of the house, just a block away from where the boys lived, with no luck. No luck, that is, until days before we were scheduled to finish this final episode of the podcast. We've now been in touch with the current occupants and asked to talk with them about the history of their house and to ask for a look in the basement. Before we contacted them, the owners had no knowledge of the Klein case or the role their basement may play in it. So far, they're thinking about my request, but as with all the open-ended parts of this story, I will be back with any updates. What I have seen is pictures of the basement from when the house was offered for sale in 2017. These photos show a concrete floor that appears to have been recently painted, but it's impossible to see whether the floor itself has been replaced. If the bodies of three little boys were hidden under the floor, they may still be there. A professionally administered forensic examination could determine that. But if the Klein brothers never were in Lloyd Paddock's basement, what else can we hope for from renewed attention to this story?
If by some miracle those boys did live and grew up somewhere else, they could be anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or someone who knew them could be anywhere. So,
or there could be down the river in Wisconsin or Iowa, somebody sitting in law enforcement who this was not entered, this going through the reports, just the same way that we got started in ours, going through old reports and, whatever happened with this person that was found. And all of a sudden we have that connection. So that's kind of how we got into it. It keeps going.
Like Doolittle, these determined investigators are using every resource at their disposal to find answers. And I would not be doing this now, and this case would likely be practically forgotten without the work of Sheriff's deputies Lance Sauls and Jessica Miller. I know their work isn't completely done, neither is mine, but it does feel like an ending for all of us.
So what's next for Sauls and Miller?
The Klein case isn't the first cold case that we've kind of worked on together. There's other cases within Wright County that we've done reviews on, you know, that sort of thing, and had conversations on. This one is obviously a lot more in depth than some of those. But I don't we've already had discussions on what's the next adventure, what's our next case we're gonna work, you know, something that we can kind of do, and maybe we'll get further with that one and just kind of see what happens.
How do you feel about this chapter coming to a close?
Grateful. The big thing about it was neither of us wanted it to disappear.
I would agree. I think we were able to do more than we both thought in the beginning. We didn't expect it to be 7 to 8 years. But it was, and I think that I'm happy about where we're at with it, about what we did accomplish. And obviously, we would like a conclusion. That would have been the best ending, but we're not there yet. But it doesn't mean that we won't get there.
If it is resolved, either soon or not soon, later, how do you think you will feel once that happens?
Just happy for the family, that they have that answer that they've been waiting so long for. And that, you know, I guess it'll be gratifying, persistence pays off, and that it would be very a neat thing, something that started in 1951, and how many people have worked and had a piece and a part in this case all the way up to the end to get it to that point is something that I think is just really neat. It's so many people working on this together throughout decades, you know, that never even met, but yet they were pieces of building this puzzle together to get for the same goal.
And here again is cold case expert Everett Doolittle.
You asked me earlier, is it worth it? Well, you know, I don't think you're going to get a task force. I don't think you're going to get a bunch of people. But what you can do is try to make it alive. You got to bring life back in this thing because it's gone. Nobody's waiting to call you unless they know somebody's working on it and they want you and they need the help. Because somebody knows something and somebody cares, but why call it so many years ago? Who cares? Nobody knows, you know, but you got to make them care. And that's really what this is about, I assume, trying to put life back into it. Time shouldn't mean that we don't care. Nobody has a right to come in and take somebody away and take a life away, and which affects the person's gone. But all the loved ones, all the friends, everybody that cares about this person, forever their lives are changed. And you think, God, they got to get over it. Well, you know, that's not that easy. And especially with no answer, especially not knowing if that guy next door is the guy that hurt your child or is gone. The family deserves that. The friends deserve it. The community deserve it. We all deserve not to forget about people who were harmed when we have a responsibility to protecting them.
We owe all this to the Klein family. They need and deserve our care and attention. If we can't bring them resolution and certainty, we sure can give them care and the resolve to keep them and the case in mind, always. Here's Donald.
I think a lot of it comes from compassionate people that follow this case. I think that they were born compassionate people. I think they live as compassionate people. And I think they are compassionate people. Because there certainly have been a lot of them that would rather got swept under the rug. You know, for the few that do pursue this, look at the many that are exact opposites. They got a heart of stone. They just don't care. It's not me. It's not my kids. I think we've just been lucky and have run into very compassionate people.
When time is running out, as it did for Betty and Kenneth Klein, compassion seems all that's left. Is it enough? Sitting with Donald, I felt the complexity of all this, his open heart, love of his family, and gratitude for everyone who has taken an interest in his brothers over the years. But I also felt a sense of urgency, even after almost 70 years. His parents never got the answers they were looking for, and he feels like time is running out for this generation as well. And who is responsible for that? Where can he ultimately put that pain?
I don't want my brothers forgotten when I die. I want to put a headstone up there, but I can't do it because if I do it now, then they'll close the investigation because they're deceased. I don't know they're deceased. I just don't want them forgotten. And I think they deserve to have their names with my parents. But hey, Minneapolis Police Department keeps that from happening, you know? I don't know what to say, you know? I mean, I understand everybody makes mistakes. I've made them. I know I've made mistakes. And I don't understand how it is people, when they know they make mistakes, don't go back and try to correct it. I watched my parents die wondering to the end why they were kept from it, why God would do that. I watched my mother cry. That's hard. I watched my oldest brother suffer. They stole part of our lives, you know. We can't get it back. But at least maybe we can put a headstone up. Maybe we can get together and shed our tears or shed our fears. I don't know. But maybe we could move on. And who knows, if there's an off chance, maybe we could meet them.
When I asked your mother what she thought it would be like if your brothers either returned or hadn't been missing to begin with, her answer was, well, I'd have a lot more grandchildren.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and there's probably more truth to that than even she realized or we realized. You know, our families have been small. I had never had children. My brother Mike had one. Gordy only had one child. My brother Tom, two. My brother Lance, one. And I'm wondering if a lot of the reason that they didn't have more children was subconsciously better to put your eggs in one basket that you can concentrate on and watch over than to have too many and fear of losing them, not being able to be there, just plain the fear of potential loss. It has to be in the back of our minds all, you know, it has to be there. I don't know how it couldn't be. I think it's just that I grew up with it. And it's something that's just a part of my matrix.
If what we know about your brothers never advances beyond what we know right now, do you think it's still possible for your family to find a feeling of settlement or closure?
Closure will come when we pass. We'll know them. We'll know them. Until then, it's our duty to keep going. And it is a duty. As much as anything else, it's a duty. We owe that to our parents.
You talked about this vision you have of putting the gravestones of your brother's gravestones there next to your parents. Could you say a little more about why that's important to you?
I don't think they should ever be forgotten. I never got to meet them. I've already had their memories or, you know, anything tangible. The birthdays, the dinners, the births, the sicknesses, the trials, that, you know, stole from me. But that's something nobody can steal. That can be put there so that they can be remembered as they were the sons of Kenneth and Elizabeth Klein. And no matter what happened to them, how it happened, how it played out, they're the sons of Kenneth and Elizabeth. And you can't steal that.
We've heard about the disappearance of the boys, the apparent mishandling of the case by the Minneapolis police in 1951, later investigations, and the family's long search for the brothers. The Minneapolis Police Department, by the way, has not responded to my requests for comment on this case. Who should get the last word about this agonizing, frustrating, and seemingly endless case? The first Klein I interviewed was Gordon, the last living member of the original family of six, and one of the last people with direct memories of the lost brothers. He's also the living person most hurt by their disappearance, and their vanishing sent his life spinning in a completely unwanted direction.
What do you remember of the personalities of your brothers then?
Well, Davey, he was basically a little devil, you know. He's just always doing stuff. So Kenny, he was, I don't know, I guess more like I was. I could say that because we were just, you know, Danny, he's a follower. He was, you know, he was acting like one or the other all the time. So he hadn't gotten his own personality yet.
Can you imagine what they would be like as grown-ups?
Yeah, I've thought about that. In fact, I think about that quite often, what it would be like if they were still here and, you know, here, where I could see them, how we could get together and do things and reminisce about how bad we were when we were little and, you know, what people do when they get older.
Yeah,
you know.
It'd be nice for you to have that.
Yeah.
Is there anything that we haven't covered that is important to you or you think worth mentioning?
No, I don't think so, not. I want to thank you guys.
Thank you. For me, just speaking for myself, you know, I've been writing about this and researching it and working on it for more than 20 years now, since I first wrote a magazine story about it, about your parents' search. And, you know, there's no other story I've ever worked on that's like it. And
yeah,
it's so important. I wish more people knew about it.
Yeah.
And I deeply hope somebody will come forward.
Yeah, so do I. So do I.
Well, who knows? Maybe we can cast a beam of light on this.
It might shake somebody else loose out of the woodwork, you know, in some other case. That's the whole thing. You open people's eyes and they start thinking and, you know, a lot of things can happen.
It's unpredictable.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Gordon. This has been very good, and I hope we're able to bring about what you hope for.
So do I.
Hope. That's what it turns out this podcast is about. The hope of parents, brothers, investigators, uncounted empathetic people. Their hope, our hope, isn't vague and wispy. It's solid, warm, and real. It has always sustained the family. Despite the work of so many people, the case of the lost Klein brothers remains messy with loose ends. I will return with any updates, but for now, this is the end for us. We have hope.
Long Lost is a production of Twin Cities PBS, written by Jack L. High and produced by Katie O'Rourke. Original music by Robert L. High. Audio engineering by Terry Gray. Additional sound by Eric Poggle, Joe Demko, and Johnny Hagen. Managing Director Brendan Heenahan, Executive Producer Daniel Pierce Bergen, Production Manager Ted Hink, and Production Coordinator Ann Guttridge. Special thanks to the Minnesota Historical Society and KSTP Archives, and the University of Minnesota Press, publisher of Jack L. High's new book about the Klein case, The Lost Brothers. Funding for this podcast was made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and Friends of Minnesota Experience. You can reach us at longlost@tpt.org and visit us at tptoriginals.org/longlost to learn more about the case.